Welcome to the Running Explained podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth. I'm a marathoner, coach, and answer seeker. When I first started running at the age of 29, I had so many questions and what felt like nowhere to turn to for answers. And now I'm here to answer all your running questions about anything that you might want to know. If you're a new runner or you've been doing this for a long time, there's always something more to learn about running. So let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome to the Running Explained podcast. I'm Elizabeth. I'm super excited you're here for this week's episode. It is absolutely jam-packed with info. Of course, I hope all my episodes are jam-packed with info, but this one like really is. Before I introduce my guest, of course, though, I do want to periodically remind you that I am more than just a podcaster. Of course, I am a coach and I have a bunch of resources and information and stuff available to you as a runner if you are looking for more support, guidance, education, in your running. So not only do I have 28 different training plans available all on my website, I have a variety of masterclasses, Training Plus for the half and full marathon for the self-coached athlete. It's a ton of education, training plan, heart rate zones masterclass, and a coaching consult with me. I also have group coaching available for half and full marathon. So if you are training for a half or a full marathon and you want not quite as much as one-on-one coaching might offer, but more than just doing it on your own, check out group coaching. And of course, the gold standard one-on-one run coaching, fully personalized, individualized coaching written just for you, having a coach in your corner every day of the week to help guide you towards your goals. We have a couple spots available left on our roster. Let me know. You can schedule a free exploration coaching call on the website. All that's available for you on the website, runningexplained.co. Now, my guest this week is sports chiropractor Luke Nelson. Luke has been a sports chiropractor for 20 years. He is incredibly accomplished and credentialed. He is also an endurance and ultra endurance athlete himself. So not only does he work with athletes, he is, of course, a runner, a marathoner, ultra marathoner, Ironman, triathlete. He understands us endurance runners because he is one. Now, Luke is here today to talk to us all about the calf muscles and the Achilles tendon and how that all relates to running. We're going to talk about specific injuries that you might experience in the calf and Achilles tendon areas, what you might be able to do to address those, ways to improve your calf strength, talking about tendon health, and so much more. So without further ado, here's Luke Nelson. Luke, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you here.
Very excited to be here, a long-time listener and first-time caller, as they say. So I've been listening mainly out in the run with the podcast in and loving your work. So real great honor to be on today. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to have you here because I'm a big fan of your work as well. And I hope this episode will reveal why for people who don't know who you are yet. But for people who are just meeting you for the first time, and because I'm also curious, you are a runner. Tell us, how did you become a runner?
So I sort of fell into running. I dabbled in it when I was younger and with a cross country like we all do in our elementary or primary school. And I was terrible. I actually had a reminder. I did my first cross country run on the weekend. First time in 20 years that I'd, or actually 30 years that I'd done this cross country race, and thankfully it went better than that. So that first one, so I wasn't much of a runner when I was younger. It was more played a lot of basketball and a lot of different sports. Actually, I love sport, and it was only until after I finished university that it sort of became more of a convenience thing. That and we all know running is great. You can strap on a pair of shoes and off you go out the door. So that's what sort of drew me to running initially, and then. Sort of got more involved in it. I guess that pursuit of wanting to better oneself, you know, and wanting to striving to improve, and so that led me to running my first half marathon. I said I hated that and I'd never do that again. But a couple of years later, turned up for my first half, first full. Again, hated that and said I'd never do another one of those. And fast forward, I've done, you know, seven. I've done a couple of Ironman triathlons and plenty of halves along the way, and loving it more than I ever have, and hope there's many more races to come. So that was sort of my running. I sort of fell into it more out of convenience, but then just fell in love with it.
It really does suck you in, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah. It does. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
funny. I mean, I finished my first marathon. I think the very first thing I said to my husband, it was like, I don't understand why people do this for fun.
What's
I never want to do this again.
100%.
Same thing. Yeah. Six marathons later, here we are.
Yeah. So. I said that to my wife after my first marathon and my first Ironman triathlon on the finish line. I said, I'm never doing one of those again. And then after that, when I signed up for my second Ironman, she said, I'm not believing you again when you finish that line, whatever comes out of your mouth. Because you just get that, you know, it's as horrible as it might be and that as hard as it might be, you just get that, you know, even later on that day, you're thinking, yeah, that wasn't that bad. You sort of get some amnesia, I think, and you know, getting that wanting to strive for that next goal. So that's definitely me.
That relentless pursuit of yes. how good could I be?
Yeah. That's yeah.
You did it. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And actually, you know, it's funny because I had that discussion with, you know, with patients and because they want to know, you know, what they think their ability, capability is. And, you know, I often question that myself where I think I am. I think I've still got a couple of years left of improvement left in me before I hit my peak. So hopefully a few more personal bests in that time.
And obviously you are a sports medicine practitioner, a sports chiropractor. Is that something yes. you always knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, pretty early on actually, from in high school, I as I said, had an interest in sport, an interest in health, and we did a topic in school where we learned all about the human body and sport and physiology, and I just loved that. And so I knew pretty early on from our ninth year in high school that I wanted to do something in health. And but by the time I got to our final year of school, I knew that chiropractic was something that I wanted to do. I'd sort of observed some physical therapists and chiropractors and really loved the approach for the chiropractic. And so I went to study the 5 years at university. And then once I finished, again, I still had that real interest in sport. That's what sort of led me to go down the path. And this year is my 20th year in practice, actually. So we're having a reunion with all our classmates later on this year. So it seems to have gone in a flash. But yeah, love it. Love doing what I'm doing. And yeah, sport's obviously the main passion and interest.
So there's obviously when we talk about practitioners, and I have a lot of physical therapists on the show, and you know, thinking about the sports specific nature of something like what you do and how that differs from what a generalist would do, what is it that makes sports chiropractic medicine or sports physical therapy, like what is the focus here? What's the difference there?
Yeah, I guess that it comes down to really a better understanding of the athlete. And when I say athlete, that's you know, that could be a recreational runner. We say athlete. It's a better understanding of you know, what makes them tick. I guess the things that may have contributed to their injury, and also the things that we need to do to get them back into doing what they love and doing it at their best and for performance as well, not just for you know, getting back from injury, but performing at their best. So it's a better understanding of those sort of things, and that includes then learning of lots of different stuff. That's, you know, diagnosis, that's you know, rehabilitation, certain management of different conditions. So it tends to be have a greater and higher level of understanding of all those things to ensure you get the best result for that athlete.
I know that in the States, it's obviously our healthcare system is an absolute mess over here, and it's very tough for a lot of people to get the care that they need. A lot of running ISA athletes too to get the care that they need because of the way that insurance works. Or their insurance sends them to a physical therapist who like only works with geriatric people with back problems, you know, and they're like, but I'm a marathoner. And the PT says, well, you should stop running. It's like there's this huge kind of disconnect, I think, between what a lot of people are expecting from when they're getting care and what they might actually receive.
Yes. Well, don't get me started on the just stop running. That's certainly what a pet peeve of probably the number one pet peeve of mine is of people being told that they can't do something. And when actual fact, it's just, you know, poorly informed health professionals that are saying that. And it, you know, it's quite sad in a way. Like I've seen a lot of people's lives that have been changed because of that, have been told to, you know, stop doing a particular activity, and, you know, they can spiral into years of poor health and poor physical and mental health. And they're often told that unnecessarily too. So, you know, whilst we joke about it, but it certainly can be, you know, quite a serious, set them down a quite a dark path. But thankfully, you know, there is, we as much as we can, and that's again where it comes down to the sport professionals is that we try and keep the person doing what they're doing. So that if that's the runner, we try and keep them involved, or try and have them running in some sort of capacity if they can. But if not, then trying to get them back to it as soon as possible.
And today we're talking about the calf, our calves. I obviously am not a PT. People who have listened to the show have heard me say that repeatedly, but I do field a lot of questions from people, from injured runners or runners who are experiencing aches and pains in certain places and asking for my guidance. My guidance is probably like, you should go see someone who knows what they're talking about and can diagnose you. But I get a lot of questions about calves and the calf muscle complex and all of that. So today we're going to learn all about our calf muscles as runners. And the place I always like to start is, Luke, go ahead and educate us about what is the calf? What are the muscles we're talking about? What do those do when we run?
So how long have we got? We've got, so for anyone that does follow me, they know my love for the calf muscles and the appreciation there. And that comes from, seeing a lot of runners and field sport athletes. And the calves are really important for those particular sports and for running. The most important, if we look at Tim Dorn did a study back in 2012, and he looked at all the different muscle contributions that are involved in running, and we can see from his work that even at slow running speeds, the calf muscle, that the lower calf muscle called the soleus, is involved, that it can do up to six times and at slow speeds and getting up to eight times body weight of work, which is a huge amount of work done by this muscle, greater than any other. And so we know that just as a bit of an anatomy refresher rule for our runners out there, the calf complex, as we say, is made up of three muscles. So we've got the soleus, which is the deep muscle. That's usually mainly down the bottom, but does reach all the way up to behind the knee. And then we've got our two gastrocnemius muscles. So we've got a medial and a lateral gastrocnemius, and they go on, they're sort of more in the higher part of the calf there. And then there's a fourth muscle called the plantaris, but it doesn't serve as much a role in terms of force production. Those three main calf muscles, they go down and blend into what's called the Achilles tendon. And the Achilles tendon, we'd all know, unlike the Greek mythology Achilles, where it was his weakness, for us, it's an incredibly strong tendon. And it's stronger than any other tendon in our body. So the calves are obviously really important for running. They also are the muscle for propelling us forward as well. So if we look at, there was some research done by Hamner, and they looked at all the different muscle groups and at what point of the running cycle were they active, and we can see the calves at propulsion. Calves are pretty much the main thing that's doing up to 90% of our propulsive forces. So they're the things that are driving us forward, and obviously for a runner that's pretty important. They especially that lower calf muscle, that soleus, is involved in change of direction. So when we're sort of moving from side to side, more relevant, I guess, for our trail runners, when we're changing direction through there, but also all our field athletes as well, when we're having to quickly change direction and push off from there. They also propel us upwards. When we jump and we're doing a maximal jump up in the air, the calves are working really hard there, and in fact actually work harder than what the thigh muscle, our quad muscles, are doing. So a lot of people think it's the quads that are for that, but it's actually that the calves are a really, really important one. And so they have to, generate a lot of force, but they also have to do it very quickly, because if we look at how long our feet are on the ground when we're running, our feet are on the ground for, 0.25, 0.3 of a second. And so they have to be very, not only explosive, but they have to generate that force and very, very quickly. So when you look at it in that perspective, it's hard not to be amazed at the structure that is our calf muscles.
That is fascinating. That is so cool. I mean, obviously knowing how important our calves are, but I think it's interesting what you said about people always think about, oh, it's the quad or this. I mean, I think people, obviously, rightly so, we pay a lot of attention to our glutes as runners, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
and it sounds like the calves are not getting nearly as enough love and attention from runners.
No, our poor old glutes, they do cop a lot of blame for every injury. And, I lay the blame probably on all my health professional colleagues. leagues that have spread that, you know, blaming everything. And mind I add you, they often will place that blame without any form of assessment of strength or capacity there either as well. And that's one of the things that I'm quite big on is, you know, objectively testing. So we're objectively testing the strength of these areas and taking the guesswork out of it to say, well, actually, do you have sufficient strength? Every muscle serves its purpose. So the glutes certainly serve a role there. But, you know, like we can see from Dawn's studies that those calves are just so important. It's really only at sprinting do other muscles take over, and that being hamstrings and hip flexors. So we see what do sprinters get? You know, the injuries they get most commonly is hamstring injuries. And that's because their demand goes up exceedingly when they get to sprinting. So, but for our distance runners, it's pretty much the whole way through. It's the calves.
So in your practice, what are the most common complaints that you get from runners who walk into your clinic and say, my calf hurts?
Yeah, so most of the biggest things that I see from a calf perspective injury-wise would be Achilles tendinopathy. So I see quite a lot of that. So we're always looking at the calf there. The only other thing we'll see is calf strains. So that is common, especially in one of our main field sports over here in Australia is Australian rules football. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a bit of a crazy mix between rugby and gridiron. They're not wearing any protective padding, but anyway, they're running around a big field. There's a lot of running. You know, the players are doing up to, you know, 12, 13 kilometers in a game, and, you know, getting close to 8 or 9 miles. And there's a lot of sprinting. And so one of the most common injuries we see there is a calf strains with them. So we see a lot in runners and also in other sports. But there is also then that complaint that we get from the runner of you know, the tightness in the calf. So then that's sort of separate to a strain, but, you know, can lead to it. And we tend to find that you know, that feeling of tightness is often a sign of fatigue. And it's one way that our body's sort of letting us know that, hey, we're not comfortable with what we're being put through here. I've actually experienced it myself last year when I was training up for a marathon, and I was in a particularly big block of training, getting into my peak weeks, and I started to get quite tired through the calves. I obviously knew what it was. I had, you know, quite good calf strength, but I was just asking a lot of my body at that time. And I knew that if I'd got through that week and just, you know, made sure I gave a bit of TLC, that it would be fine. And it was. And so I just needed that, my body just to adapt to what I was throwing at it. But we often do see those runners just with every single run they do is just like they're tight, they're tired, you know, they constant need to stretch. You know, you see those runners that are at traffic lights, waiting for the lights to crop change, and they're stretching their calves on the sidewalk there. So it's quite common to see, but we often find that with those runners, it's not that they need to stretch more, it's actually that they need strength. And it's only on testing that we then say, well, actually, you've got excellent mobility there, but you need to strengthen more.
And something else that I actually experienced, and I've gotten a couple of questions about this as well, is that aside from the tightness, like it feels tightness, and I used to be, and I don't know if it's like when you're newer or you're not quite sure what you're doing, you're kind of copying what you think other people are doing. Like I remember and having no idea what I was doing as a new runner, and like I would just kind of walk out the door and like stand there and stretch, not because I knew what I was doing, but because like I'd seen somebody else do that. So I was doing that too. And sometimes I wonder how many of those things that we do are like, are you doing this because you think it's doing something? You're doing it because somebody else did it in a movie or on TV.
Exactly.
So thinking about kind of that, you know, calf tightness, but also experiencing kind of a localized muscle burning sensation, not like on the skin, but like that kind of, it feels like that extreme buildup of fatigue, like at the end of a race, but very localized to the calves.
Yes.
I've had run, and I experienced this myself after I ran in the wrong shoes for a little bit a couple years ago, but I've also had runners experience this and complain of it, specifically when they are slowing down to run in their true easy zone on easy runs.
Yeah.
Interestingly, not many people seem to complain of localized calf burning at very fast paces.
So it's an interesting one because there's a few things that can be at play there. So one, it can be, you know, it could be the fatigue, but the other thing that we can see, which can give, I mean, there's a few things that give pain in that calf area. So you can get what's called exertional compartment syndrome. And basically what that involves is you've got in our lower leg, you've got lots of compartments. If you think of like cling wrap that surrounds different muscle groups there, so you've got different compartments in through the leg there, and what can happen is that cling wrap, when we normally exercise, it will expand. Now, with people with chronic exertional compartment syndrome, what happens there is that doesn't expand, and when the blood flows into the muscle, it enlarges, and with that cling wrap holding it quite tight, they get a buildup of pressure through there, and they can actually experience, you know, a lot of tightness there that can also progress to, they can get symptoms down in the foot, so they can might get tingling or pins and needles going down to the foot. That's quite classic for compartment syndrome. But that's always something we've got my radar going. If someone's getting that consistently, and you know their strength might be quite good, then again I'm leaning further to that being a problem. At faster speeds, we actually tend to use, you know, we're using our tendons quite a lot because it's a lot of spring there, and so the muscles is pretty much acting what we call isometrically. So the muscle's actually not really lengthening a great deal. It's just basically holding there, and it's the tendons that are lengthening and contracting. And whereas at slower running speeds and you know, with there's greater ground contact time, there can be a little bit more of that lengthening occurring in that muscle there. So that's one thing that we sort of, you know, got to get our radar out there. You can also have, you know, other things that can cause pain to that calf can be, you can have the blood vessels in through the back of the knee called the popliteal artery. So you can get popliteal artery entrapment there, which can cause, you know, issues with blood flow into the leg. We can also have, you know, going even higher up into the back, and we can have, you know, back issues that can be causing pain down into the calf there as well, from what we call a nerve or a neural perspective. So that's something that we want to tease out as well. And I've had certainly plenty of runners that have been diagnosed with, you know, calf tears or calf pain because they're getting this, you know, sharp pain in their calf, when in actual fact it's coming from high up around their back. So that can be occurring as well. The other thing with muscle tears is that, and this is where they can be a little bit tricky with the calf. So when usually when we tear our hamstring, so, and touch wood, I've never done it, but when we tear a hamstring, it's that typical, you know, sniper, as in, you know, someone's just shot them in the back of the leg and they're like, oh, that's got me. I can really feel that. Whereas the calf doesn't tend to do that, and especially that lower, the bigger muscle, the more important one, the soleus, it doesn't have a great sensory supply, so it doesn't give us a really good feedback. And so what runners will often complain of is that in over, you know, close to 50% of soleus injuries, there's no event that they can remember. It's not like an event where they're like, oh bang, that's got me. So, you know, half of those, they're like, oh, something feels a bit weird there. Like they might even, you know, after the run, they're like, well, that feels quite tight. And then it just gets progressively worse. So that's something we always want to watch there, is that if we're getting that happening, then there may be something going on there. Now that's usually on one side, so it's not commonly both sides that we'll see. You know, it's pretty rare for someone to injure both sides at the same time. So we want to make sure that's we rule that out as well.
That is fascinating about the relationship between the muscles and the tendon. So talk to us more about tendons, because I am sure you as well obviously see a lot of people coming in with Achilles tendon issues. Yeah. Tell us about the role of the Achilles tendon.
Yeah, so the Achilles tendon, as we mentioned before, is an extremely powerful tendon because it's the one that has to absorb and generate that force. And we think of tendons like springs, you know, that they absorb energy and then they release it. And so it makes our running incredibly more efficient, because rather than having to contract and relax our muscles every step we take, basically what happens is that the muscle contracts, and then as we land, our foot makes contact with the ground, that tendon begins to stretch, And then as we go through into propulsion there, that tendon snaps back, that Achilles tendon, and like an elastic band. You think about stretching an elastic band, you let it go, releases that that stored energy. And that's pretty much what our Achilles tendon does. So it serves a really important role. And not surprisingly, when it becomes problematic in runners, then it makes running very difficult. And it would be the most common tendinopathy that we see in runners. A few other sites we can see around the ankle and up into the knee and hip as well, but it's the most common one that we do see, an Achilles tendinopathy. And unfortunately, as we get older, as we age and getting into our masters runners, and especially males are more prone to we're seeing this developing, this Achilles tendinopathy, but also calf issues as well too. And there's a number of reasons why we can see that happen with age. One is that as we age, we lose strength. You know, so after the age of 25, 30, unfortunately, our strength does decline. And that's why all our runners out there are doing their strength training, especially all our masters runners. It's important to keep that strength up. So that's one reason. And so as we lose strength in that muscle, that's obviously going to be putting more demand on that tendon to have to do more. And then the other thing too is also just the change in the actual makeup of the tendon. So it's made up of a lot of, mainly out of collagen, and a lot of other substances in there as well too. But the tendon's qualities can start to change as we get older as well. And so it doesn't become as efficient as storing and releasing that energy. And so therefore it can start to become a bit problematic and developing tendinopathy in that area, or calf strains as well. And we do often see them go hand in hand. So it's not uncommon to see someone with a history of Achilles tendinopathy also then having calf strain issues, because their tendon isn't functioning as it normally should. So therefore putting more demand on that muscle. So therefore they suffer a lot of recurring calf injuries as well.
I do know that one of the kind of, I don't want to say weak points, but a lot of Achilles tendon issues can sometimes manifest at the attachment points rather than in the tendon itself. Is that something that you want to explain more about?
Yeah, so that's right. So when we see problems with the Achilles tendon, there's two main sites of this, and this can occur. There's one is what we call mid-portion tendinopathy. So this is usually an inch or so above the heel, right in the middle of the tendon there. And that's mid-portion. And then we see insertional Achilles tendinopathy, which is right down where that Achilles tendon attaches down into the heel bone. Now it's about 25% of Achilles tendinopathy will affect the insertion. They can be a little bit more troublesome to, they're probably a little bit more stubborn to treat than a mid portion, mainly because you've got around that area, you've got the interaction with the shoe becomes really important. So a lot of people find like the heel counter on the shoe can really rub and irritate that area. So we've got there's considerations made there. Bad ones even, we can't have, people need to be in open heeled shoes because they just can't stand the pressure on that area. So that's one reason. The other reason too is it tends to be more prone at that insertional to stretching. So going into, like a typical calf stretch position, or standing on a step and dropping your heel down below the step can often really agitate that insertional Achilles. And we go into that position, we go into that stretch position when we walk, when we run. And so with those insertionals, especially the really angry ones, it makes it quite difficult to do those things. And we have to look at things in those cases of getting heel lifts in shoes to try and get them out of that what we call that dorsiflex position, and just taking a bit of stress off that insertional tendon. So yeah, they're the two sites. The management, as I said, is fairly similar in our approach, but there's slight nuances that we'll use, especially for insertional Achilles.
Obviously, because tendon related injuries can be a very slow timeline for rehab. Talk about how you kind of reassure your patients that, hey, just because it's not happening this week doesn't mean you're heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. And I was having this discussion with a runner yesterday, in that tendons in nature, they are slow to settle and they're quick to flare in that, you know, it takes a long time for them to get better. And it can flare up pretty quickly. If you do something wrong on it, it'll let you know about it. Now, the research has sort of shown that sometimes, you know, Achilles tendinopathy, the average time frame can be anywhere from 12 to 18 months for full symptom resolutions. And some people have ongoing issues for years. Now, what I like to sort of talk about with the runner, and you mentioned that they do take a while, but what's important though is that the runner can be doing everything that they need to be doing and everything that they want to be doing, but there might be this background of pain that's going on there. So we start to sort of shift the attention away from the pain and more towards the function. And so, you know, like with a lot of running injuries, probably calf strains, probably the one that we don't tend to run so much with pain, but with most running injuries, it's safe to run with some level of pain. And we usually sort of say like a 4 or 5 out of 10 is an acceptable level. If 10 out of 10 is the worst pain ever and 0 is nothing, 4 or 5 is acceptable during the run and then after the run and then the day after as well. So making sure that there's no big flare-ups there. So we sort of say to the runner, so we can actually be doing stuff, and if we can keep the pain below that level, we're good to go. If it's flaring up above those levels, so it's sort of getting to a 6 or 7 the next day, you're really hobbling around and quite difficult, then we need to look at something and adjusting those running loads. But I always sort of say, look, this is generally an injury that we can run through. So we can continue running with this as we're managing it. There might come times we might have flare-ups some acute flare-ups along the way that we'll manage. But by and all, we'll be able to do everything that that you want to do. But that you know, there might be just this low-level pain that's there that might take a long time to disappear. So that's sort of, I think, yeah, realistically, when we're dealing with most tendinopathies, unless you get to it really early and it's more just like an acute flare-up, you settle it down, never see it again, most of them, the ones that have been there for a little while, are going to take some time to completely go away.
Is there anything that we can be doing to, you know, I don't want to say bulletproof your Achilles tendon, but like, are there things we can be doing to basically prehab this to make sure that we are less likely to experience Achilles tendon issues?
Yeah, so there's not much that's looked actually in terms of the research that's looked at prevention of Achilles tendinopathy. It would take quite a big population to look at that. I'm a big advocate for strength training, and I know you are as well too. So strength training, I think, is something that all runners should be doing, especially our masters runners out there, because of those reasons that I mentioned early on, that we see that lack of strength as we get older, and that does make us more prone to calf and Achilles issues. So I think that in theory that you know, by ensuring that we've got good strength in that area is a great first step. I think that, you know, certainly things like just even some weighted calf raises, simple as that, working on our maximal strength, but also working on our plyometrics as well, is a really, really important one. So I'm a big fan of plyometrics, and I think that's one area that people and runners often do neglect. So they might be doing some weighted stuff, and when it comes to the calf, probably the two main mistakes I see runners make with their strengthening there is that, one, they're not going heavy enough, so they might be doing some body weight calf raises, and two is they're not incorporating plyometrics. And there was a great study done 3 years ago by Baxter, and what he did was, and this is something that I made an infographic about, but it has got the different demands on our calf and Achilles with different activities. And in actual fact, a calf raise, so just a single leg body weight calf raise, is not that dissimilar to walking. So if you can walk, in terms of the demands that puts on the calf, if you can walk, then you know, then you need to be going above a single leg calf raise. And I will use calf raises, you know, early on, and sometimes they can be good to, you know, some calf raise to get some fatigue in there to build a bit of capacity on a daily point of view. But you need to go heavy. You need to be adding some weight on to bring the demand up to where it needs to be, and you also need to get exposure explosive. You need to get up from, you know, going from jumps and up to hopping, because if we look at what exceeds the demand, so normally when we want to return a runner to say they've injured their calf or they've got some, you know, really acute Achilles injuries, we want to make sure that can they do more than what running is asking them. And if they can, then yep, we're good to go. If they can't, well then it's a bit risky to send them back out there, because the likely is that they'll re-injure and flare up their issue.
I mean, thinking about what you said about what the calf muscles can handle in terms of the demands, right? The force output. Yeah, you would think, body weight doesn't do anything. I mean, you do enough unweighted calf raises. Yeah, you're going to feel the burn and get tired, but you're going to need more than that. And it's interesting to me, especially as I work through my own, you know, lifting journey as a runner, which just sounded like the most ridiculous, my lifting journey as a runner. But it's interesting to me thinking about, you know, that so many runners simply aren't lifting heavy enough. And thinking about, you know, what can we do? What are the barriers to access for truly heavy lifting? And I honestly think for a lot of people, it's just like they just don't have heavy enough things around to lift. Not everybody has access to a gym with a full, you know, weight section. Everybody has the money to buy a home gym. And it can be tough to find things that are heavy enough that are going to produce that stimulus that we're looking for.
Absolutely. And it's something that, I think, you know, when I see runners, pretty much all of them know that they should be strength training. I'd say getting up to probably a quarter or a third of the runners that I see are doing some form of strength training and consistently. And then you've got, you know, the other two thirds that might be doing it sporadically or not doing it at all. So I think we all our runners know that it's good, but it is, as you said, it's that barrier. And I think, you know, there's a couple of reasons why. One, we love running, and so we do that, and we usually don't love the gym. So, you know, having to do something that it's like, well, I don't really like doing that. I don't want to go to a gym. So that's sort of one barrier there. So the other one is, you know, they just don't know what they should be doing. You know, they don't know how to structure it or what days to do it on. So there's sort of the understanding of how to implement that as well too. So I think that there's that. And as you said, look, the access to things, and I think that, you know, one of the silver linings to COVID over the last few years with, you know, gyms being closed is we worked out some quite intuitive ways of working out at home. And thankfully for doing calf raises weighted, you generally don't need a lot of weight. So for instance, an average, you know, say a 70 kilo, which my pounds to kilos is terrible.
It's like a little, it's like 155 pound person. Yeah.
Yeah. So about that two times. That if they're doing, you know, we want to do some weighted calf raises at home, look, we're probably looking at doing, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 kilos on a single leg and doing that for reps of 8 to 10. So it's not, we don't need that much weight. You know, if we can get a garden bucket and fill that with stuff, we can get a backpack and fill it with things. I've even had people hold on to their kids and, you know, the kids jump on their back and they start doing some weighted raises there. So we can make that work. One of the beauties of plyometrics, so we mentioned before, and plyometrics are a group of exercises for our listeners that involve, you know, quite dynamic and explosive movements. So think of things like jumping and hopping. So one of the beauties of plyometrics is they can be done anywhere. So we don't need a gym to do those. So if worse comes to worse and we're like, well, look, I really don't have any equipment at home. I don't even have anything that I could, you know, hold on to. It's like, okay, well, let's just, you know, we can work on some plyometrics then instead and you know, start with the easy stuff and work them up to more challenging things, because that will, you know, certainly strengthen the calf and the Achilles there if we do that right.
It's very popular amongst some people on the internet to talk about your muscle isn't activated, things aren't being activated. I would find it hard to run at all if my calves weren't activated. But I think what we're trying to talk about in this kind of like, well, there's a kind of a kernel of truth in some of these things, is that it's more like it's not working properly within the role of the whole chain that it's a part of, right?
Yeah.
So thinking about that, and maybe if there are mobility limitations, I know we talked about kind of insufficient strength for the demands, but kind of talk about that aspect of the calf.
Yeah, so I guess there's a few things to tease out in that. We talk about, people talk about not activating. Really, that just means that insufficient strength. And, I mentioned earlier on that I do a lot of objective testing with my runners when I'm seeing them face to face. And so I do a lot of stuff. I've got access to force plates, and I've got access to handheld dynamometers and these sort of things. So I'm able to look at and see, what their maximal strength is. So we're looking at doing like a what's called a seated isometric calf test, or a standing isometric calf test, where they're in like a squat position and they're pushing up into the bar onto a force plate underneath them. So we're looking at achieving certain things in there, like we want to see them be able to push 1.5 times body weight on a seated calf raise, upwards of 2.5 on a standing calf raise. And then we're looking at doing things like some jumping and hopping and those sort of things as well too. So we're sort of teasing out with the runner, what have they got from a maximal strength perspective, what have they got from an explosive strength perspective, and then a test that really all our runners can be doing at home is a calf raise to fatigue test, and that's looking at more the strength endurance. So they're sort of looking at different strength qualities, and not one sort of by themselves will tell you everything, but if you can get a really good snapshot of what's going on from a calf capacity perspective, you can check all those qualities. But from our listeners at home, they can be doing a calf raise to fatigue test, and really we want to be seeing them getting upwards of 25 reps for our runners, 25 reps on a single leg calf raise, doing as many as you can, and that's a pass mark there. If you're getting under that, well then we need to there's some work to be done there. So that's looking at certainly have we got that activation, or have we got that strength there. In terms of a kinetic chain, you mentioned that as well, and that is really important that we do see other areas can be involved, especially when we're looking at things like Achilles tendinopathy, which are often quite chronic, or if someone's getting a lot of repeated calf injuries, we certainly want to be looking further up that chain, up the leg, if you like. And we do often find that there can be strength loss right down that leg. And so I had one last week, and long-term Achilles issues, but they had weaker in through the quads, in through the hamstrings, in through the hip there, that pretty much the whole leg was decreased in strength. It's also important to look at what's happening on the other side, because sometimes that they may have had an old injury on the other leg, and another run recently that comes to mind was someone had a lot of repeated ankle injuries on the opposite side, and so they were actually really weak on that side, and what it was causing them to do is then they were really favouring the opposite leg, and that's the leg that started to become quite suffer injuries with the calf and the Achilles. So it's looking at not just the whole leg but the whole person as well, so seeing what's going on the other side. You also mentioned there about the mobility, and yes, we do want to see one of the good test for ankle mobility is what's called the knee to wall test. There's actually an even simpler one. We can actually use our iPhone and use what's called the inclinometer on it, which is like the spirit leveler. And what we can actually do is you can, having your lunging forward onto the leg you're testing, you drive your knee as far forwards over your toes as possible, and without the heel coming off, popping off there, and then you just use your spirit level on the iPhone, pop that on your shin, and we should see you be able to get upwards of 40 degrees of that's what we call dorsiflexion. And so sometimes, and look, it is normal to see in runners sometimes that be a little bit stiffer, and it can actually be a bit of a benefit of us to have stiff ankles. But if we're seeing a big discrepancy from side to side, so if we're seeing greater than 10% difference from side to side, and it's fitting what's going on, that may be something relevant, and we may actually need to do some stretching or working on that ankle. Had a case just early in last week actually, and he had a lot of ankle issues, recently had surgery on that ankle last year, and now he started getting a lot of calf issues on that side, and he's put in a lot of work, but he's actually got a very decreased, so if we're looking at that angle, that inclination angle there, he's at sort of 28 on that side and 40 40 on the other. So there's big differences there from side to side. So part of his rehab and of you know, in addition to doing some strengthening and explosive stuff is actually working on that ankle mobility. So it is important, and that's where I think that, you know, whenever I'm dealing with an injury, I always sort of say we want to look at least one joint above and one joint below. So if it's the knee, we want to be looking at the ankle and the calf, and we want to be looking at the hip there. And so same thing goes with the calf. You know, we want to be looking at the foot, and we want to be looking at what's happening above at the knee, and then arguably going up from that as well too. So yeah, it's really important to assess the individual, and because every injury is different, and that's why I love doing what I'm doing, because every Achilles issue is going to be different contributing factors to someone else.
How often do you see people come in with, and you know, this is not a conversation about running form, but how often do you see people come in with calf issues caused by inefficiencies in their running gait specifically, or for the most part?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So I think that, I mean, the worst example that I saw of that was a runner that came in that was having a lot of repeated calf issues, and we assess his running like we do all our runners, and he was running on his forefoot, like on his toes, like without his heels touching the ground, and I'm like, okay, I go, well, what is this, how you normally run? He goes, no, someone told me that I should be running on my forefoot, that I shouldn't be landing on my heels. And so he was landing on his heels, and I'm like, okay, well, don't do that. And he was fixed. So that was another example there. So I certainly, you know, running gait is one of these things that we'll assess and see. I probably find it not as involved as in terms of looking at technique faults. Probably not as common as what I'll see with knee issues. And I think that the main thing there is that because with the knee, it's involved in absorbing that force at impact, and so a lot of the faults that we see with running gait is that initial absorption. So being that position, whether that be that they're overstriding or landing a long way out in front there, and so that's quite demanding on through the knee and the quads there. So we see it more commonly with that, whereas the calves and the Achilles not as much. Sometimes we'll see and the area that what we call mid stance. So when our foot hits the ground, we're moving, our foot moves underneath our body, and that's called mid stance through there. And sometimes we'll see in that position if they're really, you know, if they sink quite low into the ground, so that their knees driving a long way over their toes there, that can put an increased sort of compression on that Achilles there, and that's something that we may look at with that in that mid stance position. How we usually correct that, that's often associated with those runners that have a lot of up and down movement, or what we call vertical oscillation. So those real bouncy runners, they're going up and down and they're really sinking low down into the ground there. So that's something that we will often do that, but it's probably not as common to see that with the calf and the Achilles. I tend to find the work that we do with these runners is more so from the strength side than it is from a running technique. But not to say it's there, because as I said, everyone's different, and you know, this runner, I had no idea how he ran until I saw him, and I'm like, I gasped.
Oh my god. And somebody was like, running on your heel striking is always bad for everybody. Yes, you should never run exactly on your heels. So this poor man started running on his toes. Oh my gosh. Yeah, and then he ended up seeing
exactly
you.
Right. Yeah, thankfully. And yeah, we said, no, you stop doing that. And I remember actually having another colleague of mine had someone else that did something similar. So all our listeners out there, and I'm sure that they don't do this because they're educated and listen to everything that you talk about, so hopefully none of our listeners out there are running around on their tiptoes.
Are there any considerations for triathletes because of the volume of time they're spending on the bike that is slightly different from people who just mostly run?
It's a good question, and I do see a number of triathletes, and having done some triathlons in the past myself, it's probably not as common actually, because on the bike, it's not as high demand on through the calf there and the Achilles. It tends to be a lot more sort of quad and hamstring involvement there. And it's often a cross-training tool that we'll use for runners that, you know, have got some active Achilles or are recovering from a calf strain. So it's often one of the first cross training modalities that we'll switch to because of it's got a low demand on the calf. And then if we want to start to pick it up, then we might look at then going on to an elliptical or cross trainer and then working up to running from there. So it's probably not as common in that. Also, the triathletes don't, depending on the runner too, but they might not do the same volume of running that what runners will do. So, if your average runner might be doing, 50 or 60 Ks a week, but triathletes might only be doing, 30 or 40. So running is what places the greatest demand on the calf and the Achilles. And so if they're doing more of that, well, the chances are that there's going to be some more problems there. But again, going back to our triathlete, if they have, insufficient strength there, if they're not doing, the right thing from that perspective and their training load, and then sure that they absolutely can suffer Achilles and calf injuries much like our runners can.
So thinking about the, really on top of it runner who's like, okay, I don't have any calf issues, but I did my at-home assessment and I got to like 22 or 23 unweighted single leg calf raises before failure. What can I do to improve my calf strength?
Yeah, so I think that, and again, we're talking about from an injury perspective, but strength training also can be really important from a injury prevention. I mean, I think that the research is a bit mixed in terms of injury prevention for strength training, but in terms of performance, it's pretty clear. Strength training does make you a better runner. So that's what I think. If we could say to that runner, I'd say, all right, let's try and if we can dedicate two sessions a week of strength training, and that might be doing some of those single leg weighted calf raises there, so making sure that we're going heavy enough, aiming for around 8 to 10 reps. So what we're going to do is we're going to add enough weight that we can get to round 8 to 10, somewhere in that range, and we feel like we've only got a couple more left in the tank. And this is where I think runners sometimes do underload. They're chronically underloading in terms of the weight room. They're not very good at judging how much they've got left. So what I'll often say to them is I'll say, all right, grab the weight that you've been using, do as many reps as you can. And it's not unusual to sort of see them get to 16, 18 reps when they've only been doing 8 or 10, and they've kind of been wasting their time. So that's where, again, we always want to make sure that we're pushing ourselves hard enough in the gym that we're not underloading because our time is precious. So that would be the first thing, is we do three sets of 8 to 10 reps of heavy single leg calf raises. Then we want to combine that. We can combine that with some plyometrics. So that might start off with doing some pogo jumps. Pogo jumps are great. They're just on standing on two legs and we're jumping up as high as we can, being really quick on our ground contacts there and trying to propel ourselves up. And we're doing start off with doing 6 reps of those. And so they're not just, little jumps on the spot. They're really explosive jumps, jumping up as high as we can. Starting off with 6 reps, working our way up to 8 or 10 over the process of the few months. And we can again do 3 sets of those. So those two simple things can get you a long way in terms of your calf strength. I mean, with the weighted raises, you just keep adding more weight. With the pogos, as you get better, you'll be able to jump higher up in the air, and you'll get more explosive from that. So they're really great in terms of self-progression and easy things to do. If we want to take it to another level, we can start to add some hops. So we can do some hopping in a line. Another great exercise I love is I call it 2 hop forward, 1 backward, where we're going, and our listeners can try this at home, but hopping in a line and you go 2 hops forward, then 1 backward, then keep moving forwards and 1 backwards, and you're continuously moving the whole time. And it's actually quite hard as a coordination thing, so don't be alarmed if you can't do it. That takes a bit of practice to get that one down pat. But that's also a really good exercise for that calf and Achilles strength. So two things: maximal strength and working on our plyometrics, and I think that'll take you a long way.
It continuously fascinates me how runners tend to try to turn everything that they do that isn't running into some sort of like endurance, make it harder. Because I'm already, I can hear you're describing doing these pogo hops. I can already hear somebody messaging me, well, do burpees count?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, exactly. Are you like really freaking tired and not get, I mean, no, I mean, they're not the same. There's something, but that's not what he's talking about.
Well, that's right, and again, I think it comes down from the fact that we're runners. We feel like we need to be moving all the time. So taking 1 to 2 minutes rest in a weights room is just like, what the hell? Like, that's just feels weird. My heart rate's not up. I'm only at 90 beats per minute. But they're very different activities. And again, that's where I sort of stress with when I'm writing strength programs for my runners, is that that rest break is important. So when we're going heavy, so when we're doing our heavy calf raises here, we do want to be taking a minute or two's rest after we've done a set there, or if we've done those two pairings together, we take a minute or two's rest. It's not like just this continual circuit of going from one exercise to the other, because you won't be recovering, and therefore you're not able to push that weight as heavy as you can. So just emphasizing that it is different. I mean, I tend to find that sometimes pairing up, or I usually do pair up exercises for runners, in that it's more time efficient to do that, and it's also makes them feel like they're moving a bit more without having these long rest these rest breaks. Because even I have to tell myself as well when I'm in the gym, I'm just like, no, just calm down, just take the rest. You feel like you just want to be going from one to the other and then keep moving. But no, it's a different sort of exercise. We do enough cardio and running out there on the running track. The strength, when we're in the gym, or when we're doing our strength stuff at home, it's a different workout. We're working on our strength, not on our endurance. And that's where I'm sort of, I see sometimes these exercises that trying to be like functional exercises where it's like weighted running almost. It's like, no, we don't need to do that. We don't need to be doing high repetition stuff. We do enough of that out there. Use the strength, the gym or the strength room for strength.
My final question for you, and it's a total curveball because it's not what I pitched to you on our outline, but I wanted to get your opinion, or kind of what you've noticed in the clinic, about the runners using carbon plated shoes and how they may have impacted their running gait, and if you're seeing any differences now versus 5 years ago because of the rise and prevalence of these carbon plated shoes when it comes to, well, specifically the calf.
Yeah, so I think that they're a real blessing. I mean, I love my Nike Vaporflies.
Me too.
And I've tried a number of plated shoes over the years, and I credit that to some PBs of recent times. But look, I think they're great. I love them as a tool, not just for making runners run faster, but also for managing things. And we know that quite relevant, obviously, today's talk with the calf and the Achilles, they can actually really help those injuries out. They can take that load off that area. And you often hear and speak to runners now these days that just say that they recover a lot better, when they're wearing their carbon plated shoes, that they pull up so much better. They're not so much tired in their calf anymore. Now, that I think is a great thing. So we use that quite regularly with my runners, and suggesting, and runners obviously love to hear that when I say you need to go out and buy yourself a pair of these or but I don't think and they should not be used for every run. They definitely should not be used for every run. So we want to keep them more for our speed work. So that's one way that we can use them. The downsides of them, a couple of things that we see with that. So because a lot of them, and thankfully there's more now on the market, but some of the early ones, when it was just Nike by themselves, they're not the most stable shoe. They've got quite a narrow platform there, and so we'd see some runners that would have some issues around the leg and mainly around the other stabilizing muscles around the leg there, what we call the peroneal muscles or the tib posterior muscles, and their job is to try and hold the ankle in a good position when we're landing and moving, and so when people were wearing a lot of these plated shoes too much, they started to get a bit cranky and complain. So there's that side of things. The other thing I've probably seen a bit of a rise of is more pelvic adductor issues. So sort of looking at things like adductor related tendinopathy, pubic stress issues. So a lot of more issues up through in a lot higher up the chain. And potential couple of reasons why is that by wearing the plated shoes, it's allowing you to do more. So you're running more. So that's in essence is putting more load on your body. So something else can go wrong. It might be offloading the calf and the Achilles, but things can start to go wrong elsewhere. The other thing too is that they make you run faster, and you know, they, for most people, they make you run faster, and as we run faster, our stride length increases, and as our stride length increases, that puts a lot more demand around through the hips and the pelvis around through there, so we can start to see some more issues arising around that area. So I've probably seen more of those problems, and a runner in particular comes to mind where he was doing was traveling really well with the, had some calf and Achilles issues, you know, got into some plated shoes, loving them, but then started to run into these adductor and hip flexor issues around through there as he was getting faster and faster. So I think that they can allow us to do more and allow us to run faster, but that can come at a cost if our bodies aren't prepared for that, then it can, problems can arise elsewhere.
Fascinating. I'm so glad I asked.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I just had that discussion with that particular runner just the other day, and talking about that is one of the downsides of the super shoes is that. So yeah.
For some of this stuff too, it's like, it's really hard to connect the dots on some of this stuff, right? Because you think, well, I bought that pair of shoes 6 months ago, and I, you know, I've been running, it's been fine until now. But
yeah,
you know, sometimes it is. You know, that's, I'm sure, one of the things that you ask, you know, people when they come in for an assessment is like, well, has anything changed recently, right?
Yeah.
And recently could be 6 months, right? 8 months. It's just exactly. Like, what's different?
Yeah, and it's accumulative, and that's where we sort of see, you know, we're looking back at, you know, when we're seeing a runner that's injured and we're looking at you know, at an inciting event, it's something that's caused it. It may have actually been, you know, 4 to 6 weeks before they started getting symptoms that something went wrong. And because most of the injuries that we see in running are, you know, are chronic overuse or overload injuries, you know, that happen over a period of time. So we often, you know, when I'm speaking to a runner, it's like, well, what happened, you know, this far back? And that may be looking at their training diary and you know, we look back there and, oh yeah, 4 weeks ago I went on holidays and I decided I was going to run every day because I had so much time, or I was unwell and I didn't do anything. And then, you know, then I basically went back to what I was previously doing. So these sort of things, or, you know, particularly stressful time in their life, something happened around that time. So yes, we do see these things. It's not just like, well, what did you do yesterday or the week before, but what was happening in the lead up to that. And that's really important. I think, you know, training load and assessing that is, and that's obviously where the value of having a coach is really important, is someone to oversee that and make sure that the runner isn't making these errors, because it's so easy to do. Because again, like, I could get out there and, you know, run every day, and it's not until, you know, a few weeks time that I start to run into problems. So yeah, really important one.
Luke, thank you so much for being here today. Unbeknownst to our listeners, we had some technical issues, and you were a true gentleman through all of them. So I do appreciate that. And obviously, I'm a huge fan of you and your work, and I think other people should be as well. So if they're interested in learning more about you and what you do, where can they find you?
Yeah, so probably the socials is easiest there. So on Instagram, just at SportsChiroLuke. And then I've got website as well too, which is healthhp.com.au. We've got lots of blogs and stuff on there, a lot of stuff on the calves. So calf and Achilles, so if our listeners out there want to listen to that, but lots of other information on there too that they can have a read through. But no, it's been a great honor, Elizabeth. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget, you can always find and follow me on Instagram at Running Explained. And if you're looking for a coach or a training plan, check me out. Visit my website, runningexplained.co. That's runningexplained.co. See you next time.
This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you have regarding a medical condition.